And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome along to Tuesday's 9 till noon show on this Tuesday, the 18th of June, as we head towards hopefully some nicer weather as the weekend approaches. We are going to keep it nice and bright and sunny for you today, of course. And we want you involved in the conversation throughout the morning. You know how to do it, don't you? WhatsApp and text us 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Coming up just after 10, don't forget we've got Community Garda information, where you hear for the first time the latest appeals and information from Ungarda Síochána. Joe McHugh, Deputy Joe McHugh, is going to be joining us shortly. We're going to be talking about the challenges of teachers who wish to return to Ireland from abroad, the challenges that they face. And also, obviously, maybe he might put to bed, or whatever it might be, any speculation as to what it would take for him to go back into Fine Gael and so on and so forth. That and so much more besides. You can watch the programme on YouTube. Excuse me. That gluten-free bread I had there. You can watch the show, of course, on YouTube or on Facebook. Just search out Highland Radio. You can watch on YouTube on your big TV, or if it's a smart TV, of course, as most are now, or your Fire Stick. Right, OK, let's look at what's making some of the papers today. We'll start with the Irish Times. And European leaders are set to back Ursula von der Leyen for a second term as the head of the European Commission, following a push to settle on their pick for the powerful position quickly. So her reaction on our behalf, in inverted commas, to the Israel offensive has all been forgotten, obviously. Taoiseach Simon Harris said there was a consensus emerging among national leaders of the 27 EU countries to get behind Ms. von der Leyen for another 5 years as president of the Commission. Leaders met in Brussels yesterday evening to kick off negotiations over who will be put forward for several high-profile roles at the top of the EU. The government's expected to make a decision on who it plans to nominate as Ireland's next EU commissioner shortly, possibly as early as the coming days. While government buildings remains tight-lipped, most speculation within government circles is focused on Minister for Finance Michael McGrath as the likely nominee, but Minister Charlie McConnell-Logue's name is still continued to be mentioned in certain circles for that position, though he did describe any reference to that as idle speculation not so long ago. Unfortunately, if you are planning to travel and your chosen airline is Aer Lingus, you could be in bother, because a strike by Aer Lingus pilots is likely to cost the airline between 20 million and 25 million a day, the company has warned. The airline's chief corporate affairs officer, Donal Moriarty, said last night that any such action would have a hugely damaging impact on the carrier's reputation across Ireland, the US and Europe. It appears to be designed to inflict the maximum disruption on the travelling public in terms of timing it is to happen, he said, of the strike threat. Aer Lingus pilots could announce strike dates as early as today, after they voted overwhelmingly in favour of industrial action in a fresh ballot at the weekend. Their union is legally required to give Aer Lingus a minimum of 7 days' notice, meaning their action could begin next week. The pilots are looking for a near 24% increase. Now, this is really quite significant. They want a 24% increase. How much do you think that represents? Between 40 and 45 million a year. So that means pilots would be earning around about 300,000 euro per year. Any action announced by the Irish Airline Pilots Union today could include all out strike days or work to rules. But the bottom line is that many of you may be choosing to travel over the next 2 or 3 weeks. You'll be watching on there with great interest, because not everyone's going to be accommodated on other flights either, because it's a busy time of the year. So there's no doubt, unfortunately, that there are people listening to this show that are going to be heavily inconvenienced by that. And, you know, this day and age, if you manage to get away, it takes an awful lot of money, an awful lot of planning, and probably an awful lot of time. On to the Irish Daily Mail now. And record levels of domestic abuse were reported last year, with over 40,000 incidents. But Women's Aid has warned this is just the tip of the iceberg. The charity's annual Impact Report 23, released today, shows 40,048 disclosures with its helpline and regional face-to-face services during 28,638 contacts last year. This is up 18% on 2022, and it's the highest figure recorded by the organisation in its 50-year history. Sarah Benson, chief exec of Women's Aid, said the number and nature of the disclosures is utterly appalling. We will be speaking to Women's Aid, or at least getting reaction to that story later on in this programme. 40,000 instances of domestic abuse recorded last year. That's how many is that a day? I mean, that's unbelievable. That's an unbelievable level there. On to the Irish Daily Star today. And this is another story we'll be talking about a little later on. Fewer drivers and front seat passengers in Ireland are wearing seatbelts, the RSA has found. There was a 4% decline in seatbelt wearing among drivers in 2023 compared to the year before. Now, in terms of the road safety message, there's an awful lot of people might go, yeah, well, I'm very careful on my phone, or, you know, I don't want to, I can handle the car at speed, or whatever it might be. There's no excuse for breaking any of the laws, but you cannot dispute the importance of wearing a seatbelt in terms of the difference between life and death, and sometimes even worse, very serious injury. But less people are wearing the seatbelts. Why? And what are they doing to circumvent the seatbelt wearing? Most cars now will have an annoying bing as soon as someone in the car is not wearing a seatbelt. Like, how are people getting around it? And if you're one of those seatbelt wearers, you know, you can text us anonymously. Why are you not wearing your seatbelt? Well, these new figures are according to a manual observation study by the RSA between last September and October. While there were also fewer front seat passengers wearing seatbelts, down 5%, the study says a 2% increase in seatbelt wearing among rear seat passengers compared to last year. Seatbelt compliance remains relatively high. 95% of drivers and 94% of front seat passengers and 95% of rear seat passengers strapping themselves in. But the 4% drop in the use of seatbelts in cars, that's one I find really quite remarkable. As I mentioned, the Habitats Law is in now, and the Irish Sun reports that environment ministers across the EU yesterday voted to pass legislation to restore damaged nature and ecosystems. About 9% of Irish land is likely to be affected by this, we're told. The EU passed the Nature Restoration Law following months of fraught negotiations. The legislation is seen as a key part of the European Green Deal, which seeks to establish the world's most ambitious climate and biodiversity targets. The law sets binding restoration targets for specific habitats, and it aims to restore at least 20% of the land and sea areas by 2030. Following months of debate and disagreement, the law was yesterday signed off by European Environment Ministers. And as I say, like everything, be it this, the Migration Pact, there are very strong voices that are arguing it one way or another. And it's very hard to sort of see the woods for the trees in terms of what the actual impact on people might be or what it actually means. And lastly, in the Irish Daily Mirror this morning, Ireland's recognition of a Palestinian state is being used by Israel to justify increasing illegal settlements in the West Bank. Benjamin Netanyahu said Tel Aviv had discussed steps to strengthen settlements in response to the countries that unilaterally recognised a Palestinian state after October 7 and responses against the Palestinian Authority following its actions against Israel in international bodies. He added the defence minister and the attorney general requested additional time to comment on several of the clauses. The prime minister's instructed that all of the proposals be submitted to a vote at the next security cabinet meeting. All right, okay, that was a run through the papers. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. You can give us a call too, of course, on 074 91 25000. Okay, we got this email in from a listener. I was wondering if you could highlight this topic on your programme. My son is teaching in the UAE and is planning to move home this year, so he's been busy applying for teaching posts here in Donegal. He's been lucky enough to have been shortlisted for interviews in several schools in the country, or in the county, sorry, but seeing as he's still in the UAE, the schools have refused online interviews. When applying for these posts, the application form states clearly that at present he's teaching in the UAE. I can't understand why is the case. We all know of the shortage of teachers in our lovely country, and we all know of the mass immigration of our young people. And now, when some of them are making the move back home, they come across this. Deputy Joe McHugh is a former Minister for Education, so we thought he might be a good person to talk to on this. Good morning, Joe. How are you getting on?
Good morning, Greg. How are you getting on?
Doing fine,
I'm
thanks.
I'm getting on good.
Oh, good. All right. So, what's your take on this? I mean, can you understand why maybe they want to see face-to-face, people face-to-face, sort of get a real sense of someone, or what do you think?
Yeah, look, I think the preference is face-to-face, but, you know, having gone through COVID and also the fact that we've so many teachers abroad, schools do facilitate online interviews. Now, the only thing I would say, I don't know if that's primary or secondary, but I reached out to John Boyle and the INTO on this, and I mean, the INTO line is very, very clear. You know, yes, the preference is to have in-person interviews, but they also want to facilitate online if they can't be there. So I think if it's primary, I think John Boyle would be helpful to that listener, and I'm happy to put that person, that mother, in touch with them. And also, if it's a secondary level one, I know John Gorman from Tours Awalia has been very, very proactive in trying to get teachers back from the UK, and he's also concentrating in the Middle East. And I think there has to be a way around this. During the pandemic, every single school, primary and secondary, were doing online interviews. And just once again, while the preference is to be there in person, I think, like, if you have somebody in the Middle East now that's looking to come home, the cost involved in flying home and back and losing teaching time over there, like, that's something that should be facilitated, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think it's really a case, isn't it, of common sense needs to prevail here, really, because it's a lot to expect someone to either fly over for an interview or to jack in their job and come over and then start the process. You know, we need teachers. We'd love to see people back. You know, as I say, a bit of common sense to facilitate that. We did a lot remotely, as you quite rightly pointed out, during COVID.
Yeah, that's it. And look, I know maybe, you know, interview panels and boards of management may take a decision, and, you know, maybe do the look at in terms of fairness. Does an online interview give an advantage over a person in person? Like, maybe there's questions around these, but I think if every participant is given the option, whether they're in Dubai or whether they're in Dunkaneely, you know, I think that the option should be there. And look, most schools now have the facility and the technology to do that. So I would encourage the mother of that student to get in contact with either John Boyle or John Gorman if it's a secondary school issue.
Yeah, but you believe that particularly in primary level, a solution can be found in that regard, and hopefully also in secondary level.
Yeah, that's it. And like, one of the things coming up now in September, there's an extra 500 posts of responsibilities going into primary schools. So, I mean, that's going to free up more options around school places. And I know the INTO campaign are looking to reduce the class size by 2. And that will be looking at, they'll be looking at more teachers as well. So there has always been an issue around, you know, creating a sort of a progression of responsibility within schools. Like, everybody wants to move on to the next post. They work hard. They want a position of responsibility. But with 500 posts now in the primary school sector, that's something that will free up school places. And I think there'll be options there for people who want to move up the ladder.
Is it still the case that experience overseas doesn't really count to your career progression in the Republic? And do you think that's perhaps a key area that needs to be looked at in encouraging people home?
Look, I think there are anomalies. Some schools abroad, if they're public schools, they can be included in that incremental acknowledgement, for the want of a better word. But if you're in a private school, you're not. So I mean, most young teachers that comes out of the system, they go to places like Abu Dhabi and Qatar and different places, and within months they could become principal of these schools. And that's enormous experience to be doing that over a period of 3, 4, 5 years. And like, we really, really should be looking at the value of that. And I know the other argument is that that's accounted towards pensions, and there's another debate around that. But at the same time, the rich experience that some of these teachers are getting abroad as deputy principals and positions of responsibility, that's something that we should value, I believe.
Yeah, particularly if they are filling a need. Do you know what I mean? If we were in a situation where we had an abundance of teachers here and then it all of a sudden felt really unfair or uncompetitive or whatever it might be, but we do have these, you know, experience gaps and we have the jobs and the availability. And, you know, at this point, whatever happens down the line, it would make an awful lot of sense to actually avail of that experience that's been learnt overseas.
Well, yes, and into the bargain as well, because of the pressures and stress around positions of responsibility, principals at the moment are finding the curriculum and the things have changed so much in the last few years, the different pressures around that responsibility that there will be openings for deputy principals, positions of responsibility and principals. So having that rich experience would be a good thing.
And a listener says, as someone who works in the medical field, we interview people all of the time online. If we didn't, we'd never have any doctors in Ireland. I can't understand why they wouldn't embrace the online interview. That's a really good point, actually.
Yeah, it is. I don't know, the last meeting we had with Sean Murphy was talking about the different positions responsible within the hospital and different consultants and, you know, reaching out to the UK all around the world and to go further afield. And nearly all of that's done online, yeah.
On to speculation, and it's ongoing really, about your future within Fine Gael. I mean, just to be clear, regardless of what happens, you're not contesting the next general election. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's correct.
So even if the hatchet was buried in Fine Gael and they acceded to whatever red lines you had, I mean, you're heading towards your political retirement now in terms of the Dáil, aren't you? So that's not going to change one way or other.
No, that's not going to change. My personal preference is to end my days in Fine Gael.
Yeah.
I started up in Fine Gael. You build up friendships within any group, whether it's a sports team or political party, and that's where I feel at home. But when I took the decision around, I know this is history now and boring listeners around.
No,
this,
it's fine. It's good. No harm.
You know, I felt at the time that I could use my position to get transfer of eligibility and penalty free downsizing, you know, across the line. And unfortunately that didn't happen. And I felt on the one hand, I felt that I was, you know, reducing my power and influence within the party and within government by doing it, but I felt it was the right thing to do to do it on behalf of the people, to try to highlight the issue that yes, on the one hand, yes, it is a good scheme in terms of the commitment of Exchequer funding over a 20-year period, but for the here and now, for so many people, it's not a good scheme. They're finding difficulty with financial issues, cash up front, and even, you know, the daunting, I suppose, experience of becoming a QS, an architect, an engineer, and trying to deal with the whole process of rebuilding their homes. And that is, I just felt at the time that was the right thing to do. And I still feel it's the right thing to do, and try to use my position as somebody who's voting with the government on other issues, but in terms of the de facto blocks issue, that's where I have a problem.
Did Simon Harris reach out to you after his elevation to Taoiseach, I wonder, or vice versa for that matter?
As far as I can remember, he reached out to me prior to becoming leader of Fine Gael. So he reached out, that was the very first, I think that was a week before his inauguration. So after that, he reached out to me again, yeah, on an informal basis, and said he would like me back in the party. And I think, look, the motivation for a political party to have a TD back in the party is obviously to be of assistance during elections. As you know, Greg, I wasn't directly active in the last local and European elections because I felt it would have been hypocritical by doing that on the ground, and also having my stance in Dublin. So, I mean, there's a general election coming up. I won't be standing. There will be a Fine Gael candidate or candidates. And no doubt you know, I personally, I would like to be involved in that. But as of today, if the election's called today, I wouldn't be involved in it.
I think in speaking to Simon Harris through this programme, I think he is a good listener, and I think he does understand certain situations. And you do get the feeling from speaking to him that he might want to try and resolve some of the easier to resolve stuff. But then again, after those conversations, nothing appears to happen. I mean, no one could have articulated the stance better than you can, because you've made the sacrifice that you did. Like, does he believe the stuff could be worked on? Did he give you any indication that he will go back and see if at least some ground can be conceded to, you know, to the homeowners on some of these issues? Because I believe he gets it, but then you wonder, you know, is the system such that even the Taoiseach can influence a scheme like this?
Well, I do believe he is, you know, conscientious, and he is interested in doing something, and he said he would be interested in looking at it and taking it away. So obviously, between the pressures of the locals and the Europeans and the aftermath of it, you know, there is, I believe there's a window now for him to do that comprehensively and get his, the people around him to look at this. I reached out to him again in the last week to try to get a one-to-one meeting. When that happens, I'll probably have more of an idea of where he's thinking. But look, there's a number of issues there. Minister Dara Brown now has an opportunity to increase the cap by 10%. That would be an extra 42,000 for people. That would be a significant change. I know the SEI grant in the last week is going to be significant, but that was already in the legislation, so that was going to happen anyway. You know, one of the things that Johnny McGuinness called for, and Johnny is as a result of Mike, is no longer a councillor. And I think the fact that he called for a Taoiseach-led response, I think if something like that was done, that would be very helpful. Now that we're hearing all the different counties that are involved, this is not a Donegal issue. I know you keep talking about it, and your people affected by defective blocks know this. It's not just an issue for Donegal, Mayo or Clare, Sligo. It's a national issue now, and we need to grasp that nettle of treating it as a national issue, a humanitarian issue, an issue that has had such a negative effect and still has such a negative effect on people's lives. And we have to give people hope. And there are ways we can do that. And if I'm a pensioner and I have no relations, if I'm entitled to the scheme, there should be a facility for transfer of eligibility. I know a pensioner can bequeath the house to their son or daughter, but not every pensioner is in that position. So that, you know, there's another small area that won't be extra cost to check exchequer that should be looked at.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it. That's former Minister for Education, Deputy Joe McHugh there. We are going to be talking about getting your passport in order. What's the story with the passport service if you are intending to travel? That's coming up after these. Now, you're welcome back to the programme. Una Fannin is Head of Policy, Strategy and Legal with the Passport Service and joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Una. Thanks very much for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me this morning.
Okay, right. There could be a couple of things complicating people's travel over the next while. Some of it's certainly outside of our control with what's going on Aer Lingus. But the other thing could be your passport. And I suppose every single season, or every time of the year for that matter, Una, people perhaps take their passport out with not too long to go before their holidays and or their break, and they realise that the passport is out of date or is perhaps going to be out of date before or during the holidays. So you come across that quite a bit, I would say. I'd say that's what a lot of the panic, quite a bit of the panic, where it comes from.
Yes, we're very busy at the moment. It is what we would call our high season. People getting ready, planning their summer trips now, especially as the school holidays are coming up. And so I suppose our big message this year and every year is to apply in plenty of time and to apply online. So our Passport Online service is the most is the quickest turnaround, and it's the most effective way to apply for your passport to ensure you have it before your travel date.
And you say busy. I mean, it's almost 500,000 passports. In fact, you'll break through that presumably this month, issued so far this year. I mean, that's huge numbers.
Yeah, actually, as of this week, we've issued 600,000 passports.
Oh, wow.
To date. So before the end of June, before halfway through the year, were over 600,000 passports, which would be a record for us. So yes, we're seeing very, very high demand. But that said, there are no backlogs, no delays. So once people get their application into us on time, they will have their passport on time.
What is the current application process or timelines at the moment, Una?
So again, the best way to apply for your passport is to apply online. So I'll go through the turnaround times for your listeners, just so they understand what that turnaround time looks like. So for a simple adult renewal, so if you've previously had a passport and you apply online with us, you will have your passport within 10 working days. And that can be often can be quicker than that. And then for a complex renewal, and that would be for somebody who's maybe changed their name because of marriage, or for a child renewal. So if your child needs a new passport, that is 15 working days through our passport online service. And then for first timers, that would be our, you know, young children and babies who've maybe never held a passport before, or new citizens, it is 20 working days through passport online. Now, we do also offer a postal service, a paper application service, but that does take considerably longer. It's 8 weeks for the post passport service. So certainly we recommend that people use our passport online service.
And across the board at the moment, pretty much 100% of passport applications are being processed within these timelines or even ahead of them in cases. I mean, we often get the stories that come in that someone sent away for a passport on a Monday and it come on a Wednesday. That's not the commitment you're making today, but things seem to be working much more smoothly at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We're not having any backlogs or delays. Now, I would say it is important for our applicants to make sure they submit everything that they need to submit to us on time. Those turnaround times that I mentioned go from the date on which we receive your supporting documentation. So not the day that you apply online, it's the day that we receive your supporting documentation. So for a child, for instance, we'll need a consent form from the guardians that will be witnessed. And so we'd ask that people send those in to us as soon as possible so that we can start working on your passport application.
I have to go for a third time for our young son's passport. On the two occasions, firstly, I went to a Garda station to get it witnessed, but it was a part-time Garda station. And then the second time, it was a 24-hour Garda station. And on both occasions, it seems the passport office was unable to get in contact with the Garda. I presume you have to actually speak to them specifically. And I thought it was being processed. We thought it was being processed. And then eventually, weeks later, it was sent back saying that, you know, contact wasn't able to be made with the witness. How common is that? And what can an idiot like me do to avoid that the third time I try?
So I would say for child renewal, so if your children have had passports...
This is first time in this
instance. Okay, yeah. So any first-time application does need to be witnessed by Garda. I would recommend that you attend a larger Garda station that has a good range of opening hours. We do find some of the more rural Garda stations are closed.
But however, it is the specific Garda you have to make contact with, isn't it?
No, we don't. We ask that the Gardaí record the witnessing in the station logbook.
Okay.
And we just need to get that confirmation from the Garda station that the witnessing is in their logbook. So we don't need to speak to the specific Garda. So we will call the Garda station three times to try and get confirmation of the witnessing. And if that fails, we will call the superintendent's office to see if we can do it. So we will check four times on that Garda signature before we ask the applicant to send in a new consent mm-hmm. form. I would say it is very important that we do get those signatures witnessed and witnessed correctly. That is part of our integrity and security process to ensure that we protect the rights of the child and their guardians, and to ensure that all the guardians have provided their consent correctly.
Another complaint we've had in the past, and maybe it's resolved now, but just to bring it up in any case, is that the progress bar, you know, it can go up and then it feels like it can go back again and go up and down and up and down. Does that need looking at so people can get as clear a picture as possible as to the process of their application?
Yes, we have been doing some work on our passport tracker, and I think people will find that it's a lot more accurate now. There's information on our website as to what the different statuses mean. But essentially, you will have an issue by date once you go onto the tracker, and that will be you know, the turnaround time from your for your specific type of application. That said, if there's a document missing or if there's something wrong with your photo, we will have to reach out to you and request additional documents or maybe a new photo, and that will push that issue by date out. So it's really, really important that people give us plenty of time and don't leave it to the last minute. So as soon as you are thinking about booking a holiday, I would say take out the passports, make sure they're in date, make sure you can find them, make sure all the kids have one, and certainly do send those off to us as soon as you can. Another thing I would mention, Greg, is if people are stuck, we do have an urgent appointment service at our offices in Dublin. You can apply for an appointment to have your passport turned around in either one day or 4 days. So if you do find, you know, you're a week before your holiday and you can't find the passport or it's out of date, do contact us to get an urgent appointment, and we can facilitate that for renewals only. We cannot do that for first-time applications.
Okay, Una, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it. Just one question, see here if it's coming in. Can you ask, sorry, just last question. Can you ask how you update your passport card? Passport was issued for 10 years, but card is for 5. So they have a passport that's 10 years, yes, and the card's 5.
Okay, so so the passport card is valid only for 5 years, and it is generally issued if people apply for a package of a book and a, mm-hmm. and a card. The book will have 10 years and the passport card will have 5 years, but you can renew your passport card. So you can make a new application for a new passport card. The reason the passport card is valid only for 5 years is just because of wear and tear on the document. It's a credit card size our credit card sized card that people hold in their wallets generally. So, you know, there can be a lot of wear and tear on it. So you can apply for €35 for a new card with for another 5 year validity.
Okay, Una, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it. That's Una Fannin, Head of Policy, Strategy and Legal with the Passport Service. And also to book your travel insurance when you book your holiday, if you're lucky enough. A lot of people book the holiday and then book the travel insurance just before they leave. But the travel insurance can cover an awful lot that potentially could happen dependent on the policy between when you booked it and when you depart. So it's good advice too, if you're lucky enough to be getting away, to book the travel insurance as soon as you can. Are the teachers who are on career breaks being paid a retainer? So are their positions effectively being held for them? I'll check into that. Just to let you know, by the way, if you're on the roads, there's a lorry off the road at the turnoff for Dromahol on the Lifford Road. Gardaí are currently at the scene. We don't believe there is any injuries there. That's more to be cautious on the approach. Hi, Greg. If they opt into the migration pact, does that mean we have to accept 30,000 on top of the tens of thousands arriving from England and other non-EU countries? As I say, the migrant pact is one of those issues whereby some say it's fantastic and it will reform this and it will do that, and the others believe it's a floodgates situation. I can't answer that off the top of my head. We'll dig into it a little bit. It's very hard, actually, to get someone who can go through it all that doesn't have a dog in the race, so to speak, but it's something we are working on. Right, OK, we are going to be speaking to dog behaviourist Kathleen Murray after we take this break. Right, so yesterday, obviously, we were discussing on the programme a gentleman who was out running in Muff on Sunday and was bitten by a Rottweiler and very seriously injured. And that has connotations. He suffered a very serious injury to his thigh and had to go to hospital for treatment yesterday morning. And obviously that sparked a conversation about restricted breeds. We don't have banned dogs in this country. We have restricted breeds. Rottweilers are on them, which means that if they're out in public, they must be on a lead no longer than 2 metres. That lead has to be a strong lead. They have to be wearing a collar, of course. That collar has to have the name and address of the owner on it, and they also must be muzzled. Kathleen Murray is a dog behaviourist and joins us on the programme now. Kathleen, thanks so much for taking the call today.
Oh, you're welcome, Greg. Good morning to you all.
Can we understand why there are a list of restricted breeds and why they must be, you know, muzzled and on firm leads and what have you in public?
Not really, because I don't believe in the restricted breeds list in the first place. Because my reason is I've worked with an awful lot of the dogs on the restricted breeds list over the years, and I have not seen dogs behave like the dogs that you see on the front of the newspaper or attacking people and things. So that's why I don't believe that you can ban an entire breed. Another example of that is when these dogs on restricted breeds list can be used for therapy dogs, they can be used for autistic children, they can be used with the military, they can be used in the police, drug detection dogs. How can they be used for all of those things if they're all so terrible? So it's an individual thing with each breed. It's like, say, ban all white people. It's not something that you can put a blanket ban on because or restrict, because they're all individuals. They're all different, and you have to take each one on its own individual merit. And the bottom line is you need to understand the dog you have in front of you. That's what you need to understand. Why do you have that particular breed? Is it because you like that particular breed? But do you actually know enough about that particular breed and what they were bred for and their instincts? And have you done enough to understand their needs? Are you meeting their needs? Are you actually, have you trained this dog? Do you know how to train the dog of that breed? These are the questions that people need to ask.
Okay, well, say we've got two dogs, right? A Jack Russell and a Rottweiler, for an example, and both are out walking in the park, and neither are muzzled, but both are obviously under effective control by the owner. Do you not believe that the Rottweiler creates a greater danger to the public, i.e. the strength of the dog and the difficulty in controlling it if it did become aggressive, and also the damage it can inflict with its jaws versus, say, for instance, a Jack Russell? Like, are we not comparing, you know, tiny little apples with massive oranges here? They aren't the same, because if there is an act of aggression, the consequences of a Rottweiler's act of aggression or an Alsatian's act of aggression is far less or far more severe than that of a Jack Russell or even a Labrador.
Yeah, well, when you started that that comment, you mentioned two dogs out here, both well-trained, and then you went to just because one has bigger jaws. If they're both well-trained and they're both under control, then I don't see what the problem is. And I've worked with a lot of dogs like that, and they've been out in public. It's the ones that are not well-trained. I have seen Jack Russells do phenomenal damage to people's legs as well. I have also seen a woman die from a bite from a Yorkshire Terrier because it turned to septicemia. So, I mean, just because they're small doesn't mean they can't do damage. But I can understand where you're coming from with the bigger jaws, the stronger bite and all of that. And that's what people focus on. And that's why we have so many attacks, because we're not focusing in the right place. We're not focusing on how are they doing these things? How are they getting away from owners? How are they not coming back when they're called? How are these dogs not under control like every other dog? And if you have a bigger dog, obviously you have a bigger responsibility. And that's what people are not taking seriously enough. And the other reason I don't believe in the restricted breeds list is because there's not enough people to police it. So there, how many people have you seen or observed? How many people have your listeners seen and observed with breeds on that list out walking about with no muzzles at all? And we haven't heard of incidents with them, but they're not heeding the law either. So you see, people are not actually paying attention to the law in the first place. So therefore, it's a waste of time. Then people are, they're not enough to police it. So it's a waste of time. So we have to look at a better way of dealing with this. We have to look at it a completely different way.
But Kathleen, so what do we do? I do think restricted breeds is waving the white flag in terms of proper responsible dog ownership. But we're not going to fix the responsible dog ownership. Most people are very responsible, of course. But if you can't, you know, if you have people that have dogs for different reasons or treat them certain ways, you know, we can't fix that problem. It's easier then, is it not, to impose a ban or a restricted breed? Because at the end of the day, we have to protect humans. If it was a child, and I know this is whataboutery, but if this was a child on Sunday, and I don't know if you saw the damage inflicted on this man, if that was a child, we'd be having a very different conversation today.
Well, I'd probably be having the same conversation, to be honest, because I always look through the dog's head. I don't look at the end product of what the dog has done. I'm looking at why the dog did it, because that's my job. Why? And then to address why, and then to put it right. And what I have found over the years is that people don't listen to you. A lot of people do not listen to you. You can give them the advice and they'll say, yeah, 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 and oh, yeah, I must do this, must do that, but they don't actually do it. So what do we have to do about that then? Do we need to, you know, restrict people who get these dogs? Do we have to put an over a complete ban on anything over 25 kilos? Do we, you know, we have to come from a different angle because this law is clearly not working. And I'm not saying we shouldn't restrict anything. I'm saying we definitely should restrict. But what should we restrict and where should we start?
So you would, be of the view then, say, Alsatians, German Shepherds, Rottweilers, XL Bullies, Staffordshire Bull Terriers, you say they are at no greater risk of aggression or protection of the owner or having an aggressive event. You're saying those breeds of dogs are no more likely to attack another human, to attack a human, than the likes of a sheepdog like Labrador or Jack Russell?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that all dogs are capable of this.
No,
Have you ever seen a collie?
Yeah, of course I have. I'm asking you, are the breeds I mentioned more likely, in your view, to have that have an act of aggression, to be defensive of an owner, or to attack? Are they any more likely, in your view, than the likes of a sheepdog, a Labrador, or a Jack Russell?
No, they're not, actually, okay, to be honest, because they're herding dogs. German Shepherds are herding dogs. Rottweilers are herding dogs. Collies are herding dogs. I can name an awful lot of herding dogs. Wee corgis. We all know how famous corgis are for nipping at people's heels. That's their instinct, is to run after people and grab them by the legs, because that's what herding dogs do. And if you've got a herding dog breed, that's what it's going to do if you leave it to its own devices and if you don't train the dog.
I just find it hard to categorise in the same conversation a corgi nipping at someone's heels and a Rottweiler taking part of someone's thigh off. Do you know what I mean? I can't see how those two scenarios can be treated equally in any scenario.
I can understand exactly where you're coming from there, Greg. And you're thinking of the jaw size. I'm thinking of the control on that dog. If that dog's controlled, I have worked with all of these dogs, remember. I've been in houses where there have been five Rottweilers and eight bullies and stuff like that. And I have never had a second's bother with any of those dogs. I've had them myself over the years. I've had German Shepherds. People know I've had German Shepherds. I've used them for demonstrating commands. I've used them for all different kinds of things. But it has to be that people know what they're doing. It all comes back to the person on the other end of that lead. That's where it comes back to. You can forget about the dogs. It comes back to who has the dog, why do they have the dog, have they got the dog under control? And that's why I'm saying, how can people go out and use these dogs for functions where they're in public, they're among children, they're doing all those things, and those dogs don't react like that? How can that be? And then you get a dog that attacks somebody when they're out for a walk or out for a run. You know, their instincts are triggered. The person on the end of the lead probably hasn't seen it coming. You need to see the thing coming before the dog sees it. So it's all about training. It's all about awareness. It's all about knowing the dog you have in front of you. Because you can have six different Rottweilers stand in front of you. Two of them you couldn't push out of your way because they're that lazy. They wouldn't get to their feet. Two of them would attack anything that moves in front of them. You know, and two of them are middle of the road. They're fairly easy going. They listen to what you say, but at the same time, you have to keep an eye on them. Mm-hmm. You need to know the individual dog, you know, and you need the owner that gets them. You see, people are getting these dogs for the wrong reasons. And in Ireland in particular, over the years, a lot of people got German Shepherds and Rottweilers.
But none of them are getting them to herd. You know, I mean, you've used, you've described, and it paints a lovely picture, as they're herding dogs. But none of them have. No one has them for herding.
Well, I'll tell you.
I mean, is that fair on the dog? Is it fair on you keeping a dog that naturally wants to herd? Is it fair for you to keep that dog in a rural environment, not allowing it to do what it wants to do for fear of it being shot for one reason? I mean, is that fair to that
dog? Well, take a look at, is it fair to collies to keep them in a rural environment when they're bred here?
Is it fair? I mean, maybe we're very entitled humans that we
Yeah, well, collies kill as many sheep as any other dog, and working collies kill them because they love to work and they'd run them onto the ground. Mm. So that's why collies have to be controlled on farms, because they would work all day if you let them. They'd be out there hunting those sheep all day long.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why they need to be supervised, and you need to be out in the field with them when you're working. So that's what I'm saying. If you've got a herding dog, it's going to want to herd. But you can use other things to work with that instinct so that they don't need to be running after livestock and they don't need to be running after people.
So in the last minute, Kathleen, I think you're quite clear in it. You believe this restricted breeds law doesn't work. So in a minute, what should be put in place?
I think restricted ownership is what should be put in place, to be honest. I think people need to be at a certain level. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I'm listening away, yep.
Sorry, I thought I lost you there for a second because it went quiet. I think people should be at a certain level of, it's like a driving license. I think they should have to do a theory test. They should have to do a practical test before they own those breeds that are on the restricted list, as everybody seems to target them. Everybody seems to be on about them. So if you want to own one of those, I would suggest then you can prove that you can control and handle and train a dog like that, and that you understand their instincts, and that if something runs past them at a speed, they are going to chase it because that's their instinct. Because Rottweilers in particular are bred to herd cattle. They drive cattle, and what they do is, and they still are worked in Germany and other places as herding dogs. And if they run after them, they always nip at the back of their legs. They always grab them by the back of the legs to send the cattle forward, because cattle can be stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they don't want to move. So the dog goes in and catches them by the back of the leg to move them forward, and the cattle run on then, and then they herd them. But if you've got a dog that has those instincts but has no training, you've got a lethal weapon on your hands.
Right,
Kathy. So that's where it goes on, yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it. A very interesting conversation as always. Have a lovely day. That's Kathleen Murray, a dog behaviourist. Agree or disagree? 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts.